Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Attention, collectors of vinyl. Have you ever gone into a record store and felt overwhelmed by all the unfamiliar options? Are you frustrated by the constantly increasing prices of classic rock staples? Do you avoid streaming music or long for the days when music was recommended to you by a friend instead of an algorithm? If the answer to any of these questions is yes, then check out I'd Buy That for a Dollar, a podcast about inexpensive, common, and underappreciated records that are waiting to be rediscovered. Each week, hosts Sean, Jeremy, and Peter discuss an album and the artist's history. Previous episodes include selections by the Isley Brothers, the Carpenters, the Doobie Brothers, and Donna Summer, among others. Become a bargain bin pro and impress all your friends with cool music trivia. Listen to I'd Buy That for a Dollar wherever you get your podcasts. A quick word to let you know that if you pledge $10 or more to the Creative Control Patreon page throughout April 2017, you will receive one Creative Control t-shirt while supplies last. I have the maroon one with my head on it and the sort of yellow one with the pizza lettering and in unisex, small, medium, large, and extra large sizes. So if you'd like to support the show and receive a small, medium, large, or extra large token of my appreciation, visit patreon.com/creativecontrol to view the shirts and pledge $10 or more today. Thanks! Robbie Foulkes is a brilliant singer and songwriter who is based just outside of Chicago, Illinois. Here's a little bit of a song of his called Alabama at Night.
A red tailhawk sat watchful at the faded edge of day. The phone poles and the pines rose from the scoured clay. The sun was slipping toward the Gulf in its own good time. And you would not think of death if you drove on past the signs. The old men at the roadhouse weren't too polite to stare. Where we'd come from wasn't home, and we were far from even there. The camera around my neck drew suspicious eyes to me, but we were not there to talk, we were only there to see. When their faces had said nothing, it was that I stepped outside. And in the instant I knew I would not forget the sight. Alabama at night, Alabama at night.
That song is from Foulkes' latest album, Upland Stories, which was nominated for two Grammy Awards at the 2017 ceremony and was released by Bloodshot Records, and then earned its spot on Best of 2016 album lists compiled by the likes of Rolling Stone, NPR, The Guardian, Salon, Chicago Tribune, and more. Upland Stories is certainly a favorite around my house, so I made an effort to connect with Robbie recently, and he and I discussed things like the way people listen to music and each other these days, his interest in the Second City, and
his time teaching Tina Fey how to play guitar 20 years ago, talking with Trump people on the road, and working with Steve Albini for almost 20 years now, seeing Bruno Mars and Beyonce live at the Grammy ceremony and the impression that made it on him, what the word schmoz might mean, and much more. Sponsored by Pizza Trocadero, The Bookshelf, and Planet Bean Coffee, please listen to myself in conversation with the great Robbie Foulkes on Creative Control.
Say they might. Through sunlit rooms, the wealthy walk, and the pale unshaven men to stand before each frame 5 seconds, maybe 10, and to unveil all the maker wanted to portray. But I'm not there to talk, and if I were, I wouldn't say.
Hi, Robbie, how are you?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm very well. It's very, very nice to have you on our show.
Pleasure to be here.
Yeah. Now, first of all, where in the world are you?
I'm at home in my basement in Wilmette, Illinois, just a little bit north of Chicago.
Nice. How long have you been there?
In the basement? About 5 minutes, but in Wilmette for about 12 years. They keep me chained down here, but I'm trying to bite through the chains.
They keep you chained for five-minute increments? Is that what you're saying? It's like
exactly.
a weird
prison. Well, in this case, for about an hour increment, but yeah.
Well, sorry, how long have you... Sorry, I missed all that because I was fixated on the 5 minutes, but where? How long have you been there in Wilmette?
For about 12 years.
12 years, okay. And what brought you there?
Interestingly, yeah, what brought me here to Wilmette? There was a good school system here, and we had some friends that lived here, and we were living far outside Chicago. It was about turning into a 2-hour commute for my wife, who works in Chicago every day. So we wanted to move to a little bit of a closer suburb, and that's what brought us here.
Okay, and you've lived in Chicago proper, you were saying, for some time, right?
Yeah, I moved to Chicago in 1983 when I was 21, and. Or rather 20, and then moved to the suburbs, I guess, in 96 and have been flitting about from one suburb to another since then.
Okay. And you moved from New York City, did you?
I did.
Yeah. But that's not... Where are you from originally?
I'm kind of from different places. I was born in York, Pennsylvania, and we lived there for about 3 years, and then we started moving... about once a year, sometimes more frequently than that. And we moved generally kind of southward, and by the time I was in junior high school, we were in North Carolina, which is where my parents stayed for the next 20 years. So to make a long story short but still boring, my sort of hometown allegiances are divided between, Pennsylvania and North Carolina, but really at this point, having lived much, much longer than anywhere else in Chicago, I'm pretty much a Chicagoan.
Okay. Yeah, no, that's fair. But it does sound like you were likely exposed to different cultural forms in all of these places. I mean, they're different places, right?
Yeah, Pennsylvania, Virginia, North Carolina, which are the three states that I lived in from 0 to 17, kind of culturally different, but I lived in a variety of small towns, and so it wasn't as different as one cosmopolitan, like moving from Boston to Sacramento, say, or even Boston to Portland, Maine. I think that I lived inside my head for a lot of the time when I was a kid. So my environment, I think, was more conditioned by books and music and what went on in the privacy of my room and my head than stuff going on outside.
You were something. You weren't. Well, are you sort of suggesting you were sort of introverted?
Exactly.
Yeah, you were. Okay, you were totally lost in imaginary worlds as opposed to...
Well, yeah, not totally. I mean, I had some friends from time to time, but not a ton of friends and not a ton of social life. So then once I started playing music, then that, you know, that took up, a couple hours a day of that. So, Yeah. So the outside world was a smaller influence, I would say.
I would think that if you lead a transient childhood, that your relationship to each place you're actually calling home is at least a little distant, right? You don't get as attached as you might if you're, you know, spending long periods. I mean, it sounds like you spent the most time in North Carolina growing up. But do you think that any of that transience contributed to your, let's not call it lonerism. I don't want to make you sound like you have issues, but it does seem like that might have been a contributing factor, right?
A contributing factor to ultimate identity?
Yes. Yes, as someone who treats the places you're in with, like I say, at least a little bit of distance.
Yeah, I guess my experience of it was that I didn't reflect on it. I think my memory of my childhood was that I wasn't reflecting on it deeply at the time, and that I've spent a lot of the years since thinking about it, about how the way that I grew up contributed to my idea of myself. And I think that, and my conclusion is that all that moving around and rootlessness did root me more deeply into culture, into books and music, and that living a little bit in the North and in the South, and then, you know, all my adult life in the North, gave me a little bit of divided, it gave me a sympathy with Southern culture, but distance from it too.
Right. And I mean, in sort of the biographical words about this record, the latest record, Upland Stories, there's discussion of the fact that you are in a more reflective mood than maybe you have been in the past. Is that the case?
Oh yeah, I think so. I think you can only just write from who you are, and at 53, it's just not the same as at 23.
Do you think of it as a departure, though? I mean, I would think that no matter what your age or your experience, you are always sort of reflecting on your life when you're expressing yourself artistically. Do you think that's fair? Or did you feel like you were you had a narrower view of maybe your own life and the world until more recently?
I feel like there was a definite point at which I wanted to shift gears, and that was about 10 years ago when I started working more and writing the kind of music that I've done on the last two records, and to a smaller extent on my 50 song download of 2009.
Yeah.
And so the point came when I had done the same sort of on the road presentation for about 15 years, which was a electric guitar and acoustic guitar and bass guitar and drum set. And I was tired of that, or tiring of it, and was feeling a little bit creakier in my bones, and was thinking about what I might do to make myself happier with just being on the road, and found out that through a sort of providential series of gigs where I was sitting down and playing acoustic guitar into the microphone, I thought, aha, I'm really enjoying this a lot more, and it also connects to what I was doing when I started out, when I was, 10, 15, 18 years old, as far as, not playing with a drum set and with a big, loud quartet, but doing something a little bit more, what would you call it? I guess bluegrass-ish, not exactly bluegrass, but something a little more Doc Watson-ish, I would say.
Yeah.
If your listeners know about Doc Watson. So anyway, I found that I was instantly happy doing that kind of thing. And so that was the little click that moved me on to where I am now.
It sounds like among the things that made you happy there was just the simple act of sitting. Just sitting down, being a bit more restful in your presentation.
I think it was even more the audience sitting, because I do far more of my gig standing than sitting. I would say even 90 out of 95 gigs I do standing up, but when the audience is sitting, they listen, and when they stand, often they tend not to. So
yeah.
you know, I think there was a moment when I thought, well, this is a little bit self-indulgent to demand that all audiences listen quietly to what I do. But for better or worse, that's the way that I wanted to go. I thought, I'm just going to go with this supposition that what I do is worthy of listening to and ask that of the audience. Because, I mean, it sounds goofy, but in general, I wasn't playing to listening audiences through a lot of the 90s and aughts.
Right. People weren't as into the listening as they were moving around a little bit in some way.
But we were all younger, and we were all drinking more, and we were standing up, and we were having fun. And so that got a little bit I saw that and had enough of that after a while.
I think you might have been onto something. I feel like listening habits are really on the decline, even when I go to shows or when you hear how people actually consume music now and how it's been kind of undervalued and relegated to the background. I don't think people are listening as much, so I feel like you, like I say, you might have been on to something there, just picking up on that.
Well, maybe it's being a little bit of an old fart. You know, my wife went to see this band. We both like the band Bad, Bad, Not Good, and
we
were introduced to it by my, they're from up there, right?
They're from Toronto. I know those guys. Yeah, they've been on the show.
They're fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
And we love their records, and, you know, my son introduced me to them, and my son and my wife went to see them recently, and I would love the option of going to see them and listening, but as my wife reported, it's not exactly an option. You get physically tossed off your feet and mauled at their shows. You know, you can't sort of avoid the pit. but what was I going to say? And a related experience, going off of your comment, was that I did two gigs recently, opening for a band called Old Crow Medicine Show, and I did them in New England, and it was a perfect experiment of what we're talking about, because the first night was in a theater that was all seated, and the second night was in a similar-sized theater where it was mostly standing, and I just could not, as an opening act, I couldn't approach the noise level. I couldn't communicate with more than the first couple rows of the standing place, and I really bombed, where I went over quite well at the seated place. And I walked away from the experience a little bit unhappy with myself for not having just plugged in and made more noise and realized what the situation was going to be like. But an interesting footnote was that I was back in the same city, Portland, Maine, where that theater, the State Theater, the Standing Theater, is located. I was there last week, and I went to see Regina Spektor play.
Mm-hmm.
And now I was in the audience watching the performer deal with the same thing, and the same conditions kind of applied, even though she was the headlining and indeed the only act. But the audience was so loud that she stopped in the middle of a song and said, "I'm having trouble, please quiet down." And she presented in a few short, polite sentences, went back to playing, and the audience kind of died down, the noise died down for a little bit, and then it, you know, a minute later it rose back to where it was. So it's just the nature of the room. It's a little bit of a mystery, but the room, the environment, and the fact of standing up creates a great difficulty sometimes.
Yeah, I just wonder if that's also symptomatic of our general issues with volume these days. I mean, so much political discourse occurs where people are just shouting over each other and not really listening to information, not really taking the time to process what's in front of them. They're just waiting to speak or waiting for their turn. And I don't know. I'm not a cultural theorist or a psychologist by trade, but I do think that something is going on in terms of how we interact with each other in public spaces. And I think musicians might have been the first, or any, you know, you hear about it in the theater too, just people not having the decorum, it seems, to live among each other in a civil manner. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
it seems like you're speaking to that a little bit.
I mean, I think environment is kind of so consequential that, you know, from the performance end, most of the time I can make people be a little quieter by being a little bit quieter myself. Until, you know, there's a tipping point, and at the point where you're in a room like the one that I mentioned that's so conducive to noise and partiness, you can't do that strategy. But I think that the same person that's at a Trump rally that could be, you know, goaded into smashing somebody in the face, you know, if that rally is transported to a different kind of a room and a different kind of
context,
to use the most generalized bland word.
I'm just trying person, to help here.
I know. You are helping.
With my blandness.
And that same person behaves quite differently and would never consider doing the same thing that he would do in another circumstance. So, I think the room is really consequential.
Yeah, and I think, but I do think that bland word context might be relevant just because, I mean, comedians go through this all the time. Hecklers, people having the audacity to actually try to be part of the show. I mean, you don't have that necessarily. Does that happen to you? Do you feel like you end up with people who are so...
In a comedy club, it does. But again, I mean, the whole context is, you know, the person in his head when he walks in the room is, I'm walking into a comedy club. And that brings up all these other associations and part dictating the behavior. Of the spectator. But, you know, I spend so much time these days playing in these sort of, you know, tea and cracker shishi listening rooms that as somebody heckled behaved coarsely, then, you know, it's just self-governing for the most part. You know, people are too... intimidated to act that way. You're intimidated by the people and the room around you.
Yeah, no, I hear you there. And usually that works out, but some people just have gall. Some people don't. They have maybe no shame, and they'll just speak out or won't be respectful of a performer. And it sounds like that's something you've encountered in both subtle and overt ways.
Oh, definitely. And I'm not even I think that maybe you're suggesting that there's a proper way to behave at a show. And I think that I'm not so sure that that's right. But, you know, I think that it's great to go out and to mosh and to yell and to, in certain cases, to disrespect the performer. But for what I'm doing now and the level of volume that I'm projecting from the stage and the stories that I'm trying to tell, I just prefer, you know, sitting and listening.
Yes, no, that's fair. Like you're saying, it's the room, it's the tone of the evening that you have to be aligned with.
It's the style of music, yeah. And it's the age of the performer and the age of the audience, and it's everything.
Yeah, it's true. You mentioned that beyond anything else, you consider yourself a Chicagoan, and Chicago has a rich history for music, but it also has a rich history for comedy. We were kind of alluding to that a few moments ago, and you are renowned as a songwriter for having a great sense of humor with your work. Tell me about your relationship with comedy generally and comedy in Chicago. Do you consider yourself sort of part of that world?
I've backed into it somehow, and I think a lot of it is through the Second City. You know, I've always been a fan of, first the TV show when I was a kid, and just loved it. And of course, that influence comes to bear also on early SNL, and later SNL too, which I also loved. But as soon as I moved here, I started attending. And a while later, when I came into the orbit of Tina Fey, who was a student of mine at the Old Town School of Folk Music, I started meeting people that worked there. And ever since then, I've sort of been involved with it, you know, playing there and performing there and going to shows and hanging out a little bit with the people that work there.
Yeah.
Some of them. So that's turned out to be something of a... you know, of a piece in the fabric of my life, I guess.
Yeah, from what I understand, you were Tina Fey's ukulele teacher?
Well, no, she had to learn ukulele for a sketch, and a great sketch that she did at Second City, but, I mean, the ukulele is tuned like the guitar, pretty much, so she took guitar lessons, which is...
I see, okay.
Which is this... Yeah, which is the sort of basic offering at the Old Town School. You know, I don't know if there was a ukulele class at the time, but that might have been like two people sitting in a closet. But the guitar classes are fun, and, you know, there were 15 or so people in the Saturday morning class that she took, and there's plenty of opportunity to play together and have fun and have it be a social thing. So that's what we were That's the kind of classes I was doing there.
Right. So she was a student of yours. Did you feel like she had that spark even then? This was when? This was like 20 years ago?
This is 1995, maybe.
Yeah. And did you, she made an impression on you in some ways?
Well, I would say only from the fact that, you know, when we went around the room and I said, what do you do? What's your name and where do you work? That she said, I'm an actress at Second City. And I thought, oh, well, that's really neat. Tell us about that. And she obviously didn't want to say much more about that.
Okay.
She was pretty guarded and in some ways a different person, I think, in those days. But, you know, I think I kind of pursued the relationship just based on the information that, you know, that she was an actress there and a writer there.
Right, right. Okay. And I mean, these two worlds, I often interview musicians and comedians on this show, and I find the worlds to be similar in many ways. And like I mentioned earlier, you're someone who I think does infuse your work with comedy on occasion. Do you have comedic influences per se? You mentioned SCTV and you mentioned SNL. Do you feel like those things have seeped into your work as a songwriter?
Definitely. At times it's something to sort of resist, you know, the satirical point of view. If you're trying to be sympathetic to your characters and to, I don't know, just to work in a spectrum a little bit larger than satire.
Yeah.
But, I can't completely divorce myself from that point of view. It's so ingrained after, you know, childhood with Mad Magazine and Saturday Night Live and all the rest in it.
Well, I mean, we as we're speaking, Chuck Berry just passed away, and growing up listening to Chuck Berry and the Beatles and Hank Williams myself, I was always struck by the humor in their work. Some of it was sly and some of it was quite overt. Did those kinds of things make an impression on you, like sort of funny songwriting?
Well, yeah, that's a whole other thing. I mean, whenever people have asked me about, you know, tell me about this element of humor that sometimes occurs in your songwriting. Do you ever worry that da-da-da, as if, you know, I sort of invented it, but I've always loved funny music, you know, whether it's explicitly funny, you know, in its aims or whatever, like Stan Freberg and Spike Jones, but also, as you mentioned, you know, a funny song of the Beatles, like Why Don't We Do It in the Road, or even just a lighthearted song like Martha, my dear.
God,
I'm blanking. My dear, I almost said my love. Yeah. Martha, my dear, or, you know, Monkberry Moon Delight, or these other like sort of cutesy Paul McCartney songs, you know, I just love them. And then when I really got into country music as a young adult, I found that there was this whole tradition where almost every major country star that you could name before the 1970s, from the Louvin Brothers to Buck Owens to Merle Haggard, they all had funny songs that they did just as part of their repertoire of, you know, the idea of a Saturday night and going to a show that you would hit the tragic and the comic and several points in between. You would present a variety show idea of a repertoire, mm-hmm. that moved from through those different tones. So I was, I guess that's one of the things that just endeared country music to me, that now you could have a comedy element. You know, you could do a tragic song about drinking, and then a supposedly hilarious song about your uncle falling down on a banana or something, and they would all fit into the same thing. But of course, at the point where I was doing this thing in the 1990s, it did sort of require an explanation because the music had moved on and had fragmented a little bit, and the idea of, you know, you could be serious and funny from one moment to the next had waned a little bit.
Well, I do think that country music is among the first forms to really look life in the eye and view it as, you know, inherently absurd. You know, singing about death or your troubles, it seems to be trivializing these things, but I think it's a way of neutralizing them. And I don't think many forms, at least early musical forms, did that better than folk and country music. They just sort of dealt with the reality, in some cases, the somber reality of life.
Sure.
It just sounds like you, when people approached you about the comic elements of your music, they seem to be, just based on what you said earlier, they seem to be treating that aspect of your work as a novelty. Is that fair?
I guess so. I mean, to me, novelty isn't a dirty word. It's immediately sort of perceived as a little bit of a slight or a diminishment of the form. But You Ain't Nothing But a Hound Dog is a bit of a novelty song. I mean, there are plenty
of
Tutti Frutti is a novelty song. And, Take an Indian to Lunch This Week by Stan Freberg is a novelty song. And I just can't turn my back on those songs. I love those songs.
Yeah, and they infuse your, like when you sing a song about someone taking a lot of pills and dying, that's it's funny, but it's sort of a novelty song on some level. I don't mean to insult you. I hope you're not offended that I said that.
No, I'm not offended by anything that you would say, probably. But
really, that's interesting. I'm just warming up here. Maybe I'll throw some fastballs, some high heat, just see what happens. No, I'm not. I don't want to offend you, but that's a unique skill, I think, to present a dynamic show the way. To be honest, I've not seen you play, but you have this dynamic catalog, which I assume as a performer. That must be an amazing feeling to know that you can read the room and take it in a totally different direction just based on, you know, what the feeling is, you know, because you have this catalog of different stuff.
I guess, yeah. I don't, we're getting into a different subject, I guess, but I don't really feel 100% in control of most of the rooms that I play, that I can yank it this way and that. It's, there's a weight to a room and, the room is the lion and you're the tamer, but you know, the lion is a significant animal. And, So I generally don't feel like I have my whole catalog to work with when I'm facing a room and that I can follow any particular song with any other particular song that pops into my mind.
Yeah. When you travel nowadays, I mean, you're playing in different cities. Obviously the political climate is, all sorts of words, really. It's, at the very least, it's divisive. The easiest thing to say is it's just plain odd. It's more odd maybe than any time I remember. What's your take on your country? What's happening in your country? And also, as you've traveled, how would you read can you kind of gauge the mood of different parts of the country? Do you have a sense of that as a performer, as someone who travels?
I think I'm a little bit too much inside the bubble, the proverbial bubble, to get a very accurate feel for it. And most of my information about the Trump people comes from, not performance or the promoters, say, or the audiences or the whatever, whoever I talk to after shows, but rather, you know, sitting in the Waffle House after or talking to hotel clerks or just talking to people in the cities as I bump into them. But I feel like it's something that I feel like addressing. You know, it's such a big part of modern life, and I feel like addressing it in the stories that I sing. But I think it's boring to address it too summarily or too judgmentally, even. In other words, the candidate or the president. Is one thing, but all the people that are behind him or all the people that are concerned about the issues that elevated him to his position are quite another thing. And I don't feel to dismiss them or to diminish their concerns would be a big mistake, I think. So especially as a, you know, like a country songwriter.
Well, it's proven to be a mistake to underestimate their concerns. I think that's what has fundamentally shocked a lot of people that just didn't recognize those concerns at all, and how much power and rancor was behind them.
Yeah, I think my feeling, no matter how much they're a part of my audience, I think they're a small part of my audience, but I think my challenge, you know, as it were, is to keep writing country songs that are about modern and ongoing and universal problems, which are the problems of Trump voters as well as other voters, but not to call any names out while I'm doing it. and to keep an element of sympathy and understanding in the storytelling. You know, the more that Trumpism sort of degenerates into thuggery, the harder that that gets to do, and the less compelling, I guess, it is as an artistic aspiration. But and I can see just a little bit of that in if I reference anything about Donald Trump in a tweet or in a like an article. I recently wrote an article for American Songwriter where I got some nasty reaction from some Trump people, where they send you these Facebook messages that you can't respond to, and they talk about what is the word? They sort of have this religious comeback to you, where you get a big black mark next to your name,
right?
And you can see how that the next step in that is a threat, and then the next step is a threat against your family, and that it's we know this story from Megyn Kelly and others that have told it. When you get on the wrong side of the people, so. Anyway, there's a point at which, you know, telling sympathetic stories doesn't work anymore, but I'm certainly not near that point. I just get a little bit of a taste of it now and then from touching buttons with people.
Well, you alluded to the fact that the problems of Trump voters shouldn't be ignored, and some of them may pop up in your own work. But I think what has frustrated people who don't support Trump and people who are flabbergasted at his supporters is that some of their problems are not necessarily real problems, or they're not rooted in facts, just due to certain amount of misinformation. I mean, everyone's experience is everyone's mm-hmm. experience, and you can't argue against that. If someone says, look, I'm not getting what I need from the government, or I didn't get what I need from the last administration, how do you really argue that? But it does seem like there's a serious issue now as more plans are rolled out and more programs are actually legislated, that I think there's just been this huge, from what I gather, there's been a bit of a wake-up call. How do you negotiate that? How do you talk to people that may have been misled and brought your country to this place? I mean, that's a very, you say you've had some interactions with such people, or rather they've contacted you, but do you make an effort to have conversations with people that, you know, may have supported him and may be confused about why you don't? Do you have those kinds of conversations?
Well, my Facebook interlocutor, which wasn't really an interlocutor because I couldn't respond to him, I did think for a couple minutes. Well, I spent probably 10 minutes trying to look for him elsewhere on the internet and find another way to get back to him, because he had a long posting about all of the sins of Hillary Clinton. Mm-hmm. And so for a few minutes, I had the idea of answering not each charge, you know, specifically, but of just getting back to him so that he couldn't have the last word. But there wasn't a way to get through to him. And I think more generally, it's just not my job to engage in political discussions with people about legislation and about Benghazi and about, you know, how much money the Clinton Foundation took from the Russians. And all of this is, I mean, I'm sort of generally apprised of it in newspapers, but I don't think that I have the standing to argue it, and I don't think it's part of my job to be in these discussions with people. You know, not to mention the fact that to peel off a certain fraction of my fan base or whatever is not in my interest. So you kind of don't want to go there for that reason either. But I think when it gets to the point where I have to be doing that with people, then civilization will really like be in the dumper. But
do you personally? I know you're. I appreciate your diplomacy, but do you feel that this rash of misinformation and sort of both sides?
Yeah, the information is a problem. The alternative facts are a problem for sure.
Right.
But again, civilizationally, not at this point, and not at this point for where we are, and not for what I'm trying to do, go around sing songs to people.
Right. Right. Again, back to maybe your role in all of this as a professional musician. It's not really your job to be highlighting these things, but they may manifest themselves. These issues might manifest themselves in your work somehow.
Yeah, I mean, sure. And all of us, I guess you could say, have a role in getting past this moment. And the job is to peel away people that are convinced that that Trump is the answer to their problems. In my view,
yeah.
You know, speaking as a citizen and not as a musician, maybe, but I think that that's what we need to do. You know, maybe even to not to speak too grandiosely, but to save our constitutional democracy.
Yeah,
we need to be talking about the same information and need to have rational discussions and need to ultimately convince people that are in the sway of a huckster that and we need to find other solutions to their problems, obviously. And one of the things I think that Trump has unfortunately done is co-opted, you know, the idea that a country can control its immigration levels isn't that offbeat or offensive of an idea, but since he's sort of co-opted the conversation on one side of that, it's sort of become an offensive idea to people. So we need to get the issues themselves, I think, back to a place where we can discuss them without the thuggery and the rancor.
We've been floating in and out of discussions about comedy, and you mentioned Trump co-opting various things. I think he's actually co-opted comedy a little bit. He doesn't take the job seriously and uses most opportunities to try to just do little mini roasts of people, it seems. At the same time, you know, because you follow comedy, my sense of comedy right now is that I don't remember a time where comedy has been taken as seriously and has had as much sort of social efficacy as it has.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently. Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
As now, there's so many fake news, not fake news, that's the wrong term to use now. I'm harkening back to Norm Macdonald's Weekend Update, I think. But but these sort of satiric news shows, there's like five of them now, whereas at one point it was just the Weekend Update and the Daily Show. And most comedians anyway, feel compelled to speak out. And obviously Twitter is a platform where a lot of satire and, you know, memes and all these things. It's just like, and it has an impact. It's having more of an impact. It's creating more conversation than I can recall. Do you see that as someone who follows comedy? Do you see comedy having a larger role in how your country is functioning even right now?
I don't think it has that much of an impact. Otherwise, Trump wouldn't have been elected. I think those people are speaking to their own audiences, and they don't reach that much outside of them. I don't think when John Oliver is at his loudest and his most bracing that he's convincing anybody that might be on the other side.
Do you think it's had the opposite effect? I don't know.
I think so. I mean, to me, it's analogous to the Facebook post that I wake up to from my vast cadre of left-wing friends every day. It's just like people, angry people lathering each other up. I don't think it has much of an effect outside of that.
What about, there's more...
It's nice to think that it might, but...
You think in
reality... It doesn't make sense that it would.
Huh. It's a form of social criticism, but you're saying on a fundamental level it doesn't actually impact the people they're criticizing?
I don't know. I guess I'd have to see some putative evidence that it does, but...
Those recent forums about healthcare, I don't know. It's confusing. I've been very supportive of the various protests and marches that have gone on in your country and around the world. But when you step back and a couple weeks later, the thing that was being protested or something like it has actually now been enacted, you're like, well, geez, like what are we doing? How can you actually affect change? I mean, do you think much about what... I mean, obviously we have a system set up where we vote for things and that's the way you do it. But is there anything else you do in the face of what's happening right now? These are big questions for you, I realize.
Yeah, they're so far from my everyday life, and I'm probably ashamed and embarrassed that they are so far that I live in this self-centered world.
But you do.
Records.
I gather you do think about these things.
I do. I mean, I think that, but I don't think as deeply as I should, and so I don't have as ready an answer as I should. But I think that the women's protests, like the protests that I see that are broad-based and obviously represent a cross-section of Americans, that seems to me a very effective public tool. And then on the other side, when legislation is rammed through at midnight and in secrecy, when that happens, I think that then we, the other side, seem to have the upper hand. You know, we might not have the upper hand at that moment tactically, but that they're reduced to doing that, I think, shows that they're fighting a rearguard action.
And that to you is, as you say, that is something to be at least a little hopeful about. Like they are having to behave in these cowardly manners, essentially.
I think so. I mean, I think I just have to be optimistic, and I think that the system will catch up with Trump. It's been 2 months, and almost every day has been a new outrage. And I think, you know, I had I don't want to say a friend, but a guy that ran a publishing company that I was involved with for a while in the 90s that was a big, was a pretty hardcore Republican. And he said, this guy Ken Starr is like, he said, he's like Columbo, you know, and Bill Clinton can, think that he's so shrewd, but he's ultimately going to be ensnared in the logic and he's coming down. Ken Starr is like Columbo.
Right.
And I just thought, but I think in this... I think in this case that the system is ultimately, it's going to work a little bit more slowly than you might like, but I think he's going to come down.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate you fielding these questions. Again, I know they're probably a little afield of what maybe you're used to talking to, but I do appreciate it. I just, you know, when I have a, particularly as a Canadian, speaking with Americans on the show, and Americans who I think when they express themselves, they do so as thoughtfully as someone like the way you do, I mean, in your work. I just think it's good to get these insights. So I'm sorry for putting you on the spot.
The system is, as David Frum says, the system is people. So some of the people that are needed are conscientious Republicans who might be a minority, but we do still have John McCain and Lindsey Graham and other Republicans of intelligence and conscience. And so... much more weight is on those people than ever before, I think.
Yeah, and I think that these party lines are going to start to disintegrate further because I think there is a knee-jerk reaction among some to just vote for the best interest of their party. But I'm starting to see that facade crack a little bit and people are trying to vote in the best interest of constituents and the country itself, which is good, I would think. It's good. It's a healthy sign, I think. I do want to talk a little bit about someone. We've been having a conversation about outspokenness a little bit and other things. One of your primary collaborators over the years is Steve Albini, who's been a frequent guest on this show. And I was hoping you could talk a little bit about that relationship, where it began, and why it works as well as it has been.
It works because he is an engineer, and he has this very strict idea about his realm, you know. And his realm is, brands of tape and microphone placement and at least some aspects of mix. But I like to be the one that sort of arranges the music and hires the musicians and is sort of the leader of the comping, if there is comping to be done between takes and things like that. And so in our distinct realms and knowing about the realms and understanding more about his realm and the whole functioning of the relationship that we have has been largely a result of learning from him. Hmm. So I met him in 1986 through a friend and did a recording session that Halloween night of that year in 86 at his house. He was recording his house then in the basement.
Right.
And liked the guy and just continued to hire him and hang out with him and work with him over the, 31 years since.
Well, he's something of a, well, I think it's fair to say, I have a tremendous amount of respect for Steve, and he's been very kind to me on this show and in my work as a journalist, but I know he's a bit of a character. Do you have any particular stories that come to mind when you think of working with Steve? Anything he's not averse to the odd shenanigan is, I think, where I'm going. And I just wonder if you have a humorous anecdote or any kind of story that comes to mind when you think of a fond memory of him.
I wouldn't say there are a lot of shenanigans, but he's such a consistently entertaining person to be around. You know, he speaks in these, he has a very sparklingly verbal wit, mm-hmm. when he speaks. And I probably aspire to that myself when I speak, but don't quite reach the heights that he does. But I definitely like hearing him speak. And as far as, one thing that I remember that he said one time was that... which stood out a little bit because he doesn't often in a way even make musical contributions when we work together, if you know what I mean.
Like, yeah.
The fact that I work in a different genre that he knows than the one that he usually works in and knows about, and the fact that he's intellectually humble, to say, to the steel player, why don't you do this or something like that? Like, he would never do that.
Right.
So I'm not accustomed to hearing that much, what you would call, strictly speaking, musical input from him. But one time there was a horn section that I'd brought in for a tune. I forget which tune, and it wasn't sounding that good just as we were sort of setting up mics and hearing sounds come back from the room. And he said to me, kind of almost to himself, but he said, I'm not getting a real strong I can play vibe from the trombonist. Which I remember first because of the funniness of that locution, but also because it pinpointed what was the matter, and I hadn't been able to tell that the problem related to that one person.
Well, you need that honesty in that environment for sure, and who better to know than sort of someone who's somewhat objective to the process in a weird way. That's funny.
Well, yeah, he has a really unemotional relationship to the music, or I should say that he's able to go into that mode when he's recording. I think he sees that as just a basic part of his job, where he's listening to, I don't know, room sound and to some kind of a microphone artifice. And again, the fact that the trombone isn't quite the intonation of the trombone isn't quite on, whereas when I'm listening to the music, it's hard to focus on those I probably should be focusing on, but it's difficult for me to focus on those microcosmic technical aspect of it,
Yeah.
Just like when it's your song and you're singing it and you're listening to the group as a whole and it's people that you know, there's so much baggage that comes with all that.
Yeah, the last time he was on the show, he actually told the story about him being far too into the band and the experience of making a record to actually capture it properly. And I think that had a profound impact on him in terms of trying to have a bit of detachment, viewing himself as not part of the experience, but like part of the experience, but you know what I mean? Not observe, like, yeah, I think you know what I mean. I think he was like, I got to keep
talking about a specific band.
Yeah, I had Steve on with Ian MacKay, and they were in conversation. And so we were talking about his experience working with Fugazi and on the early sessions for their album, In on the Killtaker, which is kind of, the session has sort of started circulating as a demo. And ultimately, Fugazi made the record remade the record, and they didn't use the sessions with Steve. And Steve in our conversation kind of acknowledged that he kind of biffed it. He didn't quite get it, and he thinks he was just too immersed emotionally and even socially in the experience to actually do his job properly in that instance. And I think that's it. My sense of it is that really had a profound effect on how he approached sessions from that point forward.
Yeah, he's kind of like he's pretty monastic in his work habits and his approach. So I think getting emotionally involved with what's going on would run totally counter to that. And yeah. You know, personally, I think that I went to see these guys speak at a Neris event a little while ago, and their names are Terry Date and Nick, long last name beginning with an R. But anyway, they were heavy metal producers, and I was just entranced by their accounts of their experience and immediately wanted to work with either or both of them. I think that it's such a strong asset to have a guy in your corner that doesn't know about your musical genre. I would have zero interest in working with some guy with a long Americana or bluegrass resume, but a guy that has a distinguished resume in punk or heavy metal is much more appealing.
I totally can see where that's coming from. I think some people might be surprised by that, but that makes more sense to me than working with someone within. There's too many cooks, I think, is where you're coming from, right? There's just too many. If too many people have ideas, you can lose the coherence of. I mean, do you actually seek external input? Like, do you ask your wife's opinion? Do you ask your bandmate's opinion on where a song's going?
Not when I'm writing a song so much. I think probably 10 or 20 years ago, I relied on my wife's opinion more than I do now. But I don't play a lot of things for her now before recording them. I feel more confident in my own judgment. But when it comes to evaluating a mix or a performance, that you're trying to record, or most other things really outside of the songwriting thing, I do like to have input.
Okay. Yeah, that's good. Well, I mean, clearly things are working for you. I meant to say earlier, congratulations on your Grammy nominations for Upland Stories. That must have been, actually, I don't know. What was that like for you? Were you obviously a point of pride?
I haven't got a Juno yet, so I'm still not satisfied.
Well, I'll work on that. I've served on some of those juries here up in Canada. I can see if I can help you out there. I'm a huge fan of this record. Did you actually attend the ceremony?
I did, yeah.
What was that like?
It was fun. The biggest surprise to me and sort of the focus of the whole weekend, we were there 2 days, me and my wife and kids, was the ultimate ceremony, the telecast part of it, which was the part that I was least looking forward to probably, but I just didn't have any idea that it would be fun. I knew that I'd be 3.5 hours inside this room with 21,000 people in it listening to music that I didn't know anything about and thought that I probably didn't like that well. But I was just so impressed by all the music. And I mean, I'm going to sound like a big dummy, but Beyonce and Bruno Mars and Lady Gaga and Katy Perry and Chance the Rapper and Pentatonix and, oh my God, one person after the next. And the thing was that, I wasn't really impressed that it was all great music or great lyrics or anything like that. Some of it wasn't, but the performances, of course, the production, the sets and all that were awesome to behold.
Yeah.
But the vocal performances from Beyonce and Bruno Mars, holy God, they would just, and you look at them live, they just turn on the mic and they sing. And so they're doing the same job that I do, you know what I mean? But they're just doing it really, really well. And I should include Adele in that too. I forgot about her. But I mean, on that level, just hearing one great singer after another for 3.5 hours, it was It was unbelievable.
The Bruno Mars thing was among the things he did that night, if I recall correctly, was this tribute to Prince. And that seemed quite impressive on the television. What was that like in the room?
It was great.
He did like the guitar solos and everything. It was just, I think he did things that people didn't even know he could do.
Yeah. Yeah. His guitar solo was cool. And yeah, I mean, Prince is another guy that I don't know much about. I mean, I know less than I should about popular music in general. But
I had the impression that you were a very, at some point, were a very, maybe not now, but you were quite an open-eared pop music listener on some level. Don't you occasionally do the odd cover of a popular song that people might not expect you to do? I mean, you did a tribute to Michael Jackson, which I think some people found surprising. Is that something you used to do and don't do now, like keep tabs on things, or am I wrong?
Well, no, I mean, I was listening to Michael Jackson in the 60s when I was a kid. And then I found when I was in teens and 20s that he was just unavoidable. I wasn't so much a fan, but it was just, you know, you go to a mall and you'd hear it. And now the stuff that plays in malls now, for some reason, just doesn't penetrate my middle-aged skull as easily. So now I need to hear, it sort of is much more serendipitous, or my kids will be listening to something and kind of force it on me. For me to know what's, you know, happening in the popular realm at all. So I don't so much avoid it. Well, I avoid it to the extent that I'm not – I've sort of learned over my life that that's not where the stuff that I like is congregated, is in the realm of what's selling a lot of numbers right now.
Right.
But I've learned where the stuff that the stuff that I like the best just lies more, tends to lie more off the beaten path.
Right.
So that I don't, it's definitely not my first go-to, is to go to the Billboard charts and see, oh, that looks good, that looks good, I'll try this and that, you know. I've tried that, and for me it just doesn't work.
But at the same time, you left the Grammys,
But when you do find stuff that's super popular and that hits your heart, for some reason, it's more impressive, you know. I guess because you do have this idea, oh, it's popular, so it's probably a little junky, you know. That's my kind of snobbish prejudice. So when there's something about it that that you really like, it's such a pleasant surprise that it's a little bit there's a disproportion to it.
Did you end up pursuing any of the artists that impressed you at the Grammys after the fact? Did you track
as far as buying their records or something?
Oh yeah, listening to stuff. Yeah.
No, I didn't.
It was, you were just, I think it sounds like you were just mostly surprised by the experience.
Well, I don't think that I could recapitulate the happy experience of hearing Bruno Mars, you know, seeing Bruno Mars at a short distance, just singing into a microphone by buying one of his records. I really don't.
Right. Okay. So, I mean, were you treated well? The Grammys, you know, the Junos, it's a bit of a schmoz, right? There's just a lot of stuff going on. Did you
What does that word mean?
Schmoz? Oh, it means like a messy gathering, or a I hope I'm not making this word up. You never heard this word before?
Is it a Yiddish term?
It might be. I think for some reason my wife from Alberta would use that. She's not Jewish or anything, but she just uses that word, and I think it's infiltrated. I hope I haven't offended anyone by going down this road and employing the word. This is not meant to be a form of cultural appropriation. I just, schmoz came out of me, and I think it's just like a mess. Like if she's like, I was like, how is the Costco? She'd be like, oh, it was a schmoz, you know, lots of like cars and people. That's what I associate that word with. Maybe if anyone listening knows the proper meaning, my wife often gets things wrong with in terms of little words meaning things. And I'm like, what? That's not what that means. She used to pronounce the movie Hoosiers as Hoosiers, which I thought was odd. I thought that was
that
very
reminds
strange.
Reminds me that Dick Cavett said that he had a neighbor when he was a kid whose name was Outhouse, and they pronounced it Othuzi.
Yeah, see, just you see a word and you just take it in the direction you want to take it. Anyway,
exactly.
It can be, you know, it's stressful. There's a lot going on, and you're just one of many hundreds of nominees. I just, you had a good experience, it sounds like.
Well, it wasn't something I would necessarily do for fun all the time. It was a, you know, it was an aspect of my work, and I wanted to see it. You know, we pursued it avidly, the Grammy nomination, and so it didn't just come out of the sky. And once we had it in our hands, we felt like it was totally necessary to follow up and to be present and to, you know, at the very least, to learn more about the whole game so that we could pursue it more intelligently next time.
You have to apply for that award, right?
Yeah, you have to pick out, you know, one of the things I had to do was like to see what are the categories, what am I most likely to be competitive in, and then you look at the record, you think, well, what song is going to like be the one that gets the most serious consideration for this or for that? You know, there's one category called performance and another called song, so... Mm-hmm. I mean, there's no end to sort of thinking about the gaming of it, but ultimately you go by what the formal language tells you and think, well, the lyrics to this song are more meaningful than the lyrics to that song, and the performance elements of this come through more vividly than this other one, and that kind of thing.
It's got to be a bit weird to do, just thinking about it in those terms. I don't know. It sounds like you did it, so... Maybe it wasn't as odd.
I guess. I mean, I kind of think that no matter how big your act is, you know, I mean, if you were Beyonce and had all sorts of advice and this hot management team helping you out, I think at the end of the day, you're probably still in your room thinking and listening to your music, and it's still your decision to say, you know, this is going to represent me in this category. I think it's a trick for all of us to try to examine our stuff from an objective perspective, and then to put upon that also the scrim of all these, you know, formal rules, and to imagine who's going to be in the room listening to your music and how they personally are going to perceive this or that. It's just there's no end to the gaming.
Did you perform well during the weekend there?
Not exactly. There was an event at the Troubadour, a little club in L.A., the night before the ceremony, which was a tribute to Loretta Lynn. And there were a few of the nominees at that. In fact, I did a duet with a fellow nominee from one of my categories, Laurie McKenna. We did a duet on You're the Reason Our Kids Are Ugly by Loretta and Conway. And that was kind of an interesting thing in itself because... Oh, do you have time for a quick story about that one?
I have lots of time. I mean, I was winding down, but of course, please tell stories. That's what.
Well, if anybody's made it this far, this is actually a somewhat entertaining story, as opposed to everything I've said so far.
No, you've been great. You've been a great guest. I hope you're not self-conscious about this. I've been enjoying this immensely. Again, having been immersed in your music, it's nice. I like this. I like talking to you, and I enjoy. You know, I'm enjoying myself. I'm sorry you're having such a horrible time, Robbie, but it's good. I think it's good. So please, tell your story.
Please. So Lori, I just met before we sang. I didn't know her beforehand, but she's, I think she's a sensitive soul, I would say. You know, she was a very sweet person, and I just think her musical aesthetic is quieter and maybe humbler than mine or something. But we were doing this duet on this very comically vulgar song, right? You're the Reason Our Kids Are Ugly. And it's pretty much an insult competition between the wife and the husband in the song. They just go back and forth.
Right.
And there's a part at the end, in case your listeners don't know this great masterpiece of American songwriting, there's a part at the end where the two of them do what sounds like improvising, Conway and Loretta. It might have been scripted. It probably was. But anyway, you know, she says, you and your stinking dandruff. And then he says, yeah, you and your hair and curlers. And they go back and forth for about 30 seconds. Well, so in deciding how we perform this song and rehearsing with the band and all that, at the sound check, I said to her, you know, I memorized this song. I know the song, but I don't know the improv at the end by memory. So why don't we just make that up? And she said, yeah, that's fine. So
I think I know where this is going.
Yeah. At this point in the story, everybody knows where this is going. So in the performance, we get through the song, and then I started the improv part, and I said, Lori, you know, you look at your hair. You couldn't put up a little makeup on. You look so terrible. What's the matter? Why can't you just make a little effort? And she says, well, I had a flight in from Boston today. And I didn't have time at the hotel. And she said, just as if that I was truly insulted, she responded logically, as Lori McKenna. And so I decided that I was just going to dig in deeper. And for my second line, I said, well, that must have been a really long flight because you look like hell. And then she said, yeah, it was really long. In fact, da-da-da. And then
man.
So I was just like sinking, and no one was laughing. And and we were on two different planets with this thing. And so at this point, I dug in deeper yet by reverting to a line that I had thought of in the audience while I was watching other people sing beforehand. And I said to her, you know, if you just looked a little better, maybe I could get an erection, you know, again, like I used to. And she said, that's taking it too far. And, and then the song ended.
That's amazing. Oh,
and
man.
And then she beat me in the category the next afternoon at the ceremony, just maybe, which was the perfect cap to that.
Sympathy vote, perhaps. That's amazing. Wow. Yeah. That I can't believe you went in not knowing where that was going to go. I actually was worried it would be worse, that she would just, you know, crumble and a ball of tears there, but it sounds like maybe she gamed you. Maybe it was a prank on you.
I think she might have, yeah. She definitely wasn't upset by anything that happened. She was just not playing the game.
Well, I'm sorry you didn't win the Grammys. You know, I assume from that experience, you now know what to do in order to win. Did you have plans for your next recording?
That's a funny way to put it. Do you have? Yeah, I know what to do.
You know what to do?
I know who to blow next time, yeah.
Are you working on a follow-up to this last record?
Not exactly. I'm kind of worriedly thinking about a follow-up and not sure what to do, but thinking about it anyway.
You've got some shows coming up in at least, I think you're doing Texas, a tour of Texas, right?
Well, I'm constantly playing. It's kind of the way that I make money usually. So, yeah, the next run is in Texas, and then after that, some Midwestern dates, and on and on and on.
All right. Well, that's excellent. And if people want to learn more about you on the internet, obviously they can send you a dangerous-sounding message over Facebook. We've learned that. Is there are there other ways for them to keep tabs on you?
Well, I'm very accessible, so yeah, if people want to contact me, it's usually pretty easy. I mean, my shows are listed on Polestar and the usual places, including my website.
Right, and Bloodshot Records is your home.
Right.
Home away from home, home again, yeah, so people can go to their site. Is there a song from Upland Stories that you can choose for us to go out on here, Robbie?
The one that was nominated was called Alabama at Night, so maybe that one.
Okay, but again, it didn't win. So I don't know. Do we want to actually give it more attention? No, it's a beautiful song. It's the song that kicks off the record, so maybe it's a nice way to introduce people who don't know your work to it. So yeah, this is Alabama.
Another one that goes to the Trump stuff that we were talking about is called America is a Hard Religion.
I was going to ask you specifically about that song. That's the only note I had, but I felt like A, we sort of covered aspects of it, and B, it seemed to make you a bit uncomfortable. But if you want to go to that song and want to expand a little bit about it, that would be fine with me. What would you prefer?
Oh, God. I hope I wasn't too uncomfortable. If there were pauses in what I was saying.
No, not at all.
I mean, there were long pauses in what I was saying, but I was trying to organize my thoughts because I hardly ever speak out loud about this stuff,
right,
except sometimes to my son on the phone.
Right.
No, it was. So I just didn't have.
It was insightful.
Anything organ- I'm used to getting through these interviews and just like, you know, ripping off a lot of boilerplate from the last six interviews.
So it's fair to say this was a totally insightful and enjoyable experience for you.
I'm just trying to get make myself feel better because I didn't want to make you uncomfortable. But you actually learned some things about yourself potentially by talking to me. That's all I want out of this show. I hope that happened.
I feel 12 inches taller after this.
Great. That's all I want. Well, I think we should go to America's a Hard
Religion. I didn't say a foot because I didn't want it to be incomprehensible to Canadians with their odd measurement systems.
I know what a foot is. Give me a break here. I know how things work. I get around. Anyway, America is a Hard Religion. I think we should go out on that. It's a great song. What does that sentiment mean to you?
It's a phrase that I thought that red state and blue state Americans could assent to.
It's not quite blasphemous. It's almost patriotic, but it's also it sort of speaks to the difficulty of existing in that country. Maybe I don't know. I'm trying to do an explanation for your song, and I feel like I'm doing a really half-baked job. But maybe that's close. Is that right?
I think that if you think of Americanism as a religion, then and I don't know if any Canadians feel that way about their own compact with their country, but once you think of America that way as an American, a lot of things kind of click into place. I think, you know, just you can't just decide to be an American. You have to undergo. You have to go before a panel and show your knowledge of the subject and you have to undergo sacrifice and sometimes you have to sacrifice the lives of your children, you know. In other words, offer the biggest imaginable sacrifice as an American.
There's a certain expectation that you'll have an unerring faith in the leaders.
Exactly. That's what I was going to say next. Yeah. No matter what it does to you, you know, the worse that it does to you, the stronger that your faith gets.
Right. Well, I think that's well put, and I appreciate this song. So let's go out on that. Let's go out on America's a Hard Religion. Again, this is from the new album, Upland Stories. Robbie, this really was an immense pleasure for me. So thank you so much for this time and best of luck with everything in the future.
My pleasure. Thanks for making it happen, Vish.
Some rule from the sky, some inch across the ground. Their bent backs turned to all heaven above sends down. Scratch and puff from this earth, what gold it may give. Fattening on feasts to come, laboring now to live. And America's a hard religion, not just anyone may endure. America is a hard religion, some never do surrender. Sent to a savage land, mother knows not why. To plant a seed in rocky soil and perhaps to die. Freedom come it may to this child instead. Freedom comes, freedom goes, father is surely dead. And America's a hard religion, not just anyone may enter. America's a hard religion, some never do surrender. Yet we soldier on, trials to test our hearts, doubts to make us strong. Cheered by loved ones that from the graveyard say, all my tears surely gone after I fly away. And America's a hard religion, not just anyone may enter. America's a hard religion, some never do surrender.
America is a Hard Religion by Robbie Fulks. That is from his new album, Upland Stories. You can learn more about it at bloodshotrecords.com, and you can follow Robbie on his website, which is robbiefulks.com. And he is actually, as I speak to you, he has a bunch of tour dates coming up throughout Texas and all over the United States, actually, throughout April and May. Yeah, so go to robbiefulks.com for more information. Robbie, thanks again for being on the show and chatting with me. I enjoyed that very, very much, and he's great. It's great. This record is great. He's great. All his records are great. I got all his records now, and they're great. So I'm glad he was on the show. So thanks, Robbie. Hey, this show is Creative Control. This is the 311th episode of this podcast, and it would not be possible without sponsors. Fine sponsors like Pizza Trocadero, the best pizzeria in Guelph. You can call them for pickup or delivery at 519-829-2444. Or check them out at trocaderoguelph.ca. Also, The Bookshelf, an independently owned bookstore, bar, music venue, movie theater, and restaurant located at 41 Quebec Street in Guelph. And you can learn more about them at bookshelf.ca. And for the finest coffee anywhere, try Planet Bean freshly roasted, fair trade, certified organic coffee. They have 3 cafes in Guelph, and they also distribute their coffee beans throughout Ontario. For information, visit planetbeancoffee.com. This show is available pretty much everywhere that there are podcasts now, so try and track it down. However you listen to podcasts, I think you can find Creative Control now. So if what you're listening to now isn't the thing you normally listen to, check the thing you normally listen to and download and subscribe and rate and review and follow the podcast, and please spread the word about it. Again, throughout the month of April, doing a thing where if you pledge $10 or more, you get a t-shirt. Pretty much automatically, while supplies last. I mentioned it at the top of the show. Go to our Patreon page, patreon.com/creativecontrol, to make a flexible monthly donation to keep the podcast going. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Twitter, follow us on what was I saying? Like us on Facebook, I guess, and talk to us on Facebook, and follow us on Twitter, and listen to a version of the show every Wednesday at noon Eastern Standard Time via CFRU.ca, or if you're in the area, at CFRU 93.3 FM in Guelph. That's it for another episode and for me. I will talk to you, I hope, very, very soon. Goodbye for now.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.